From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to another Bletchley Park podcast extra. The GCHQ departmental historian Tony Comer came to Bletchley Park in November last year to talk about international cooperation in codebreaking, not least of which formed the foundations of the US-UK special relationship, which endures and remains vital to both nations to this day.
The Poles had treated Enigma as a mathematical problem from the word go. They'd not had a cryptanalytic tradition in the way that the French and the British had, so when they came across this new form of encryption, they simply treated it as a mathematical problem. They recruited mathematicians to work on Enigma, and the breakthroughs that they made against Enigma were mathematical breakthroughs rather than traditional cryptanalytic breakthroughs. They'd received information from the French that the French had got from an agent in the German army, and the Poles had had a lot of success until 1938, when as part of the series of increases in complexity that the Germans put onto Enigma, they got to the point where they could no longer break into the traffic. This gave the French the opportunity to call together a meeting of the British and Poles. The first one happened in January 1939 and was completely unsuccessful because neither the British nor the Polish side were prepared to reveal what they knew. It was in July 1939, after the British and French governments had given the guarantee to Poland that they would declare war on Germany if the Germans invaded Poland. It was after that guarantee that the Poles called a meeting in the forest just outside Warsaw, at which all of the information that they had was finally shared. Again, that part of the story is well known, but it's not the end of the story. The Poles shared the information they had and gave to each of the French and British an analogue of the Enigma machine, of the military Enigma machine, that they designed so that the British and French had something to work with. But the real significant sort of next part of the story comes in January 1940, when Alan Turing went to Paris. The Polish cryptanalysts had been evacuated to Paris after the fall of Poland. And he spent 3 days with the Polish mathematicians talking about the mathematics of Enigma cryptanalysis. If you look in the National Archives, I think there's a copy here of the prof's book, Turing's handbook of everything he knew about cryptanalysis. It's incredible to see how the first part of the book shows him absorbing, mainly from Dilly Knox, but also from his own studies, everything that was known in the UK about Enigma. You can then see the change that comes after his visit to Paris, after his discussions with the Polish mathematicians, where his mind is able to take cryptanalysis of Enigma onto the next level. If you like, what happened in Paris in January 1940 was the Poles passing the baton to the UK. They'd run the first lap of this race and passed it on. Turing came back with his first ideas for the design of the bomb and actually started to think about how to construct something that would actually be in place to start being useful against Luftwaffe use of Enigma at the start of the Battle of Britain. There is a sort of sad digression, a sort of sad last part of that story. Of course, the Poles were with the French. Twice there was an offer made to evacuate the Poles from Paris to come and work here at Bletchley Park, but each time it was turned down. After the armistice between France and Germany, the Poles had been evacuated to North Africa originally, but were brought back to Vichy, France, where they worked in a joint section with the French. But after the Germans occupied the south of France in December 1942. They had to try and make their escape. And it's sad to think that when Rejewski and Zygalski, who were two of the three top Polish mathematicians, when they finally reached the UK, they went to work in the Polish intercept site at Boxmoor. They never came to Bletchley. It's very sad. I mean, the sort of the analogy that people use, it's like having thoroughbreds pulling milk carts. But the fact is that as the UK developed its Enigma capabilities, it was more and more reluctant to share them too widely. They weren't shared widely even within the UK. So with whom you'd share any of this information was quite difficult. And by the time Rejewski and Zygalski reached the UK, the three people with whom they dealt, well, Turing was in America, Dilly Knox had died, and Denniston had been exiled from Bletchley Park. He'd been kicked out and sent to London. So there's nobody at Bletchley Park who actually knew and understood the value of what the Poles had done in that period before the war and during the phony war. Cooperation with the French carried on until the armistice and was very close. Apart from the UK sending SIGINT forces into France, there were three different SIGINT sites run by the UK in France in 1939 and in 1940. But much more significant was the agreement in 1940 for the French and the UK to set up a combined naval party here at Bletchley Park. The idea was that the French would stop studying the German Navy and would put all of their cryptanalysts into Bletchley Park and would put the French Navy's intercept sites at the disposal of Bletchley Park. They recognised that work on the German Navy was crucial and that the UK was far enough ahead that it made more sense to, instead of them trying to run a separate organisation, to actually put their people in here. And 10 French Navy officers actually came to Bletchley Park. Unfortunately, they came towards the end of April 1940, just as the Blitzkrieg started, which led to the Germans defeating France. But of the 10 French officers who came, 5 went back to France after the armistice. 1, though we can't find out why, must have been a singularly unpleasant character, was interned in the UK. He wasn't allowed to return to France. But 4 remained. 4 Frenchmen stayed here at Bletchley Park, working for de Gaulle and the Free French, but as integrated members of the effort here until 1944, when they could return to France. Again, it shows that the possibilities for close cooperation were there. And from 1942, ironically, just as the cooperation with the French who'd remained in the south of France with the Poles, just as that ended when the Germans occupied southern France, Operation Torch meant the landings of an Anglo-American force in North Africa, and cooperation began again with the French Y units that were in place in northern France, cooperation with the Anglo-American SIGINT forces that were there. The relationship never really warmed up as closely as it had done before. There were deep suspicions of French security or French lack of security, and there was also the problem or a perceived problem of divided loyalties, particularly after Torch, the French who, in North Africa who turned, who joined the Allies, there were none of them who didn't have friends, close relatives still in France. And there was a perceived vulnerability, pressure points that people could put on them. So the relationship wasn't particularly close. The most surprising relationship during the war, the most difficult foreign relationship during the war, was, of course, the relationship with the Soviet Union. In June 1941, when the Germans invaded the Soviet Union, they became allies, or at least they became co-fighters in the fight against Germany. Because of the need to protect Arctic convoys, it was decided that it would be a good idea to do joint work with the Soviets. In practice, the Soviets were not prepared to share any intelligence, and in fact, it's unlikely that they were producing very much intelligence themselves against the Germans. A slight digression at this point. The reason that the Red Army was able to do Siegen was an unfortunate triumph for the United Kingdom. In 1914, a small troop of people from the Royal Engineers Wireless Section, what would eventually become the Royal Signals, went to Imperial Russia to help train Russian wireless operators in how to do interception and how to process signals intelligence. Unfortunately, in 1917, the Russian Army's Signals Intelligence Organization declared for Lenin and the communists. So it's perhaps one of the slightly unfortunate parts of our international cooperation that we taught the Russians at that time everything that they knew. The Russians were very suspicious of what the British might want the intelligence for, but they did allow a small Royal Naval Station to be opened in Poliarno in 1942, and a Royal Navy officer from Bletchley Park was sent to command it. They were able to send back some intercepted messages from the German Navy, some direction finding, some bearings, but he came back to Bletchley to get better training so he could go back to Russia and be, as he thought, more productive. But within a month of his departure, the Soviets decided they didn't want to talk to the British anymore. So he got back to the Y station at Poliarno to find that all of the equipment had been sealed up. He wasn't allowed actually to operate it. It stayed on until March 1943. The mission stayed on, but they weren't allowed to operate their equipment. And so eventually they came back. If any of you ever read any of Nigel de Grey's draft history, you see he devotes a lot of time to this. There was an awful lot of very high-priced help went into trying to work out what could be shared with the Soviets and what couldn't be shared with the Soviets. Forgetting one of the cardinal principles of any sort of negotiation with any foreign country, and that is you can only share something with somebody who actually wants to share. Nobody thought to ask the Soviets whether they wanted an intelligence relationship or not, and they found out the hard way that they didn't. In March 1940, Tiltman was sent out from Bletchley Park to go to talk to the Finns. Finland, of course, was at war with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union at that point was still an ally of the Germans. And so Tiltman went out to talk to the Finns to try to work out whether they were doing anything that might be of use to the UK. In practice, he came up with something that would be the same as the pre-war relationship with the Estonians. Basically, in exchange for their intercept of Soviet material and for their solution of some low-level Soviet cipher systems, they were given a line of credit so that they could buy new and better equipment in Sweden. This was a low-level but fairly productive relationship that lasted until the German invasion of the Soviet Union. The MI6 representative in Helsinki was given a message to send to Tiltman that said that the Finns understood that we were about to take part on different sides in the war. Obviously, cooperation would have to be suspended, but they would not tell the Germans about the work that the British was doing against German cipher systems in exchange for the British not telling the Soviets about the work that the Finns were doing. And certainly from the records that were discovered after the war, it's clear that the Finns kept their word. They never, ever told the Germans about their pre-war cooperation. Before we get on to the major partnership, the last sort of couple of bits to mention are that there were relationships with both the Dutch and the Belgians as well. Quite incredibly, a small intercept unit from the Belgian Congo's militia was part of British army efforts in East Africa during the Somaliland campaign against the Italians. Again, it was one of the sort of small stories that's not particularly well known or well told. And similarly, as the invasion of the Netherlands was being planned, Dutch Y units were attached to British Y units. I must say my favourite example of supporting foreign partners, however, came in Italy, when one of the special liaison units, whose job was to provide intelligence reporting to the military, was given the task of supporting the Brazilian infantry unit in Italy. I don't think there are many people who even realise that the Brazilians fought during the Second World War on the Allied side, but they did, and therefore they got the same intelligence support as all of the rest of our allies. I'm not going to talk about the relationship with Commonwealth countries, the way the British Commonwealth worked at that time. They were an integral part of the way that the British military and British politics worked. The final country I'm going to talk about is perhaps the most obvious one, and that's the United States. In February 1941, so that's 10 months before Pearl Harbor, on February the 8th, the first four American service SIGINT personnel arrived here in this building in Bletchley Park. After the British success in the Battle of Britain, President Roosevelt decided effectively that the English Channel was America's front line, and that the United States will provide all support to the United Kingdom, short of actually joining the war itself, to be the sort of the forward point of American defence. And during talks that took place in September and October 1940, it was agreed that there would be a full exchange. On the intelligence side, the question was raised of, could the Americans be told about British success against Enigma? And the decision went to the Prime Minister. The decision went to Winston Churchill, who in November 1940 agreed that, yes, the Americans could be told about Enigma. So an American delegation was invited over to the UK, to American Army, to American Navy. And they brought with them a machine that was called the Purple Analog. Purple was the code name for the Japanese diplomatic encryption system. And they had built a machine, an analog of the Japanese Purple machine, that mimicked the way that Purple worked to allow them to decrypt it. So the Americans brought a copy of the Purple Analog with them. They had an interesting journey. They came by a Royal Navy ship as far as Scapa in the Orkneys. They were supposed to fly down here. They couldn't get their equipment onto the plane that was available. So instead, they came on another Royal Navy warship from Scapa to Sheerness. As they were travelling down the East Coast, they were spotted by a German fighter plane and were strafed with bullets. It was a real introduction to what was going on. They landed at Sheerness and were driven from Sheerness to Bletchley on a February afternoon and evening in the blackout, having been shot at, having no real idea where they were. Arrived here, there was a barrel of sherry at the entrance. Were taken into Denniston's office, were given large schooners of sherry, a drink none of them had ever drunk before. And it's a long-standing British tradition that if you get Americans drunk, you can persuade them to do almost anything. I exaggerate. They spent 10 weeks in the UK and were given full access to everything that was known about Enigma and about all of the other American systems. And in turn, they shared with the British how the Purple Analog worked, left it, and it was from that point that Japanese diplomatic was pretty well fully read from that point onwards. There were still some degrees of suspicion on the parts of the Americans. The UK was much more aware of how complex work on the cryptanalytic systems was than the Americans, because it was being studied in the context of a war of national survival. The UK was throwing all the resources it had available at the problem of cryptanalysis. On the US side, it was still a somewhat academic study. Everybody knew that sooner or later there would be war with Japan, but nobody had any concept of when that might happen. And what the UK desperately wanted was a division of effort, was a way of making sure that both sides weren't wasting time all studying exactly the same problem. And the UK's proposal was that the UK would lead on Germany, on Enigma, on German systems. The US would lead on Japan and on Japanese diplomatic and military systems. The US Navy in particular was nervous that the British would take and they wouldn't give, and asked, how can we know that you will share everything with us? Denniston, who was still in charge, had the inspired idea of saying, why don't you put some of your people into our teams so you can see everything that we produce? And that way you'll know that everything that's of interest is being sent to the United States. It was a pragmatic solution to a problem, but it actually changed completely the way that the intelligence relationship worked. Every one of the relationships I've described so far was a transactional relationship. It was based on the exchange of finished material, of intelligence reports, or of very carefully defined areas. With the Americans, for the first time, it was a completely integrated operation. By the end of the war, there were 236 US military personnel based at Bletchley Park in all of the different operational areas. And that meant that the SIGINT that was being produced was as totally integrated as well. And that's why that particular partnership has endured for as long as it has, because the two organisations gradually became so wrapped up in each other, shared so much of the ways in which they worked, shared so much of the technology that they used, that it would have become much harder to separate the two organisations than to keep the relationship going. And in particular, in 1943, a US delegation that came, led by a colonel, Colonel McCormack, went to Barclay Street, where Denniston had been exiled to, and where the work against diplomatic systems was carried out. And you can see, if you ever see his reports, this blew them away. They'd seen Bletchley Park, they'd seen the way that military analysis and reporting happened, but the way that diplomatic work was being done was the model. This was the way they would build a SIGINT organisation for the future. I'll sort of conclude and say, what do foreign partners bring? Why was there the keenness in the First World War? Why was they so encouraged to restart the partnerships at the time of the Second World War? I think fundamentally there's a sort of delta that comes when people approach the same problem from different angles. People from a different cultural background, perhaps, in the case of the Poles and Enigma, mathematicians rather than cryptanalysts. The sort of discussions that take place when people from different backgrounds approach the same problem provides a level of understanding that can produce really great things. It only happens on the signals intelligence side. There isn't anything like the depth or complexity of relationships on the human intelligence side. But the cooperation does bring its own benefits. Last July was the 75th anniversary of the meetings in Warsaw. And we went to Warsaw. I went with my director, the French director, the Polish director. We all met in the same facility in the Piri Forest where the people had met in July 1939. The only difference between then and now was that we actually had the BBC with us recording what went on. It was interesting that for all three countries that were there, all three SIGINT organisations that were there, it meant the same thing to each of us. It was a demonstration of the value that our partnerships with foreign countries bring. It's a reflection, too, of the fact that whilst the closeness of the relationship that we have with the United States and with our old Commonwealth partners is as deep and close as it has been since the war, we have a lot more relationships as well. And the relationship in particular with the French is as close as it's been for most of the last 100 years. You can be absolutely certain that over the last two or three days, the work that will have been carried on at GCHQ to support what the French authorities are doing in their hunt for the terrorists who committed the atrocities of Friday is being done at exactly the same sort of pace as if it had happened in the UK or if it had happened in any of our other allied countries. As the world shrinks, as technology brings more and more countries closer, It means that the work we do with our foreign allies becomes just as important as the work that we do to support our own national interest. As the world gets to be a smaller place, the world gets to be a more dangerous place, we need to support our friends, and in return, we get their support.
On Sunday, the 3rd of April, Bletchley Park presents Sir John Dermot Turing. Dermot will give a unique family perspective on his famous uncle, the codebreaker, mathematician and pioneering computer scientist Alan Turing. Tickets are on sale now in the Bletchley Park shop and on the website. Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.